This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet, Robin Dow Producing. And your number is 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Now, many of you are preparing. Maybe some of you are in your cars and on your way to destinations for Independence Day, long weekend. But we are live today, and we hope to hear from you. And there is much to discuss with us. Political consultant Mary Patricia Ray in studio, and joining us by telephone is Troy Michael Hebert, the unique man who had represented Louisiana and the Acadiana area in the House and Senate and the Louisiana Legislature, former commissioner of the Office of Alcohol and Tobacco Control. And before we went on the air, I got an email from a listener saying, ask him who he beat in 2007. Who did you beat for the state Senate 15 years ago, Troy Hebert?
Well, first of all, good morning, Mary and Jim. And I think the guy's name y'all might have heard of, his name is Jeff Landry.
You beat him like a drum, didn't you?
Well, all you got to do is win. 50 votes plus one. And, you know, the rest can go south.
51-49% for Troy Hebert. Jeff Landry's had a few defeats. He got whipped by Charlie Bustani, too. But he is, of course, positioned as a strong candidate for governor. And I think he's all in. And the election is not so far away. And I'm sure in the coming months, we will be talking with Mary Patricia and with Troy Hebert about what's going to happen in 2023. But right now, it's 2022, and there is much on the table. Yesterday, a new Supreme Court justice was installed in Ketanji Brown Jackson. The vote to approve her was 53-47. All 50 Democrats and Republicans, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski, they voted for Ketanji Brown Jackson. She actually got in much easier. 53 votes is easy than Brett Kavanaugh, who's 51-49, and Clarence Thomas, who's 52-48. But unlike 1992, when John Breaux and Bennett Johnston, Democrats, voted for Thomas, this time the Republicans Cassidy and Kennedy voted against Ketanji Brown Jackson. And Cassidy, of course, is making waves as a possible gubernatorial aspirant. What do you think, Mary Patricia, about him voting against Ketanji Brown Jackson?
Well, you know, a majority of the court today were appointed by presidents who never won a popular vote and confirmed by a majority of the Senate that represents less than 50% of America's population. So I think it's a two-way street with people voting against other people's appointees, but we've got a bench that may not be representative of at any point in our history in the last 25 years, the actual majority view of Americans or majority experience, because I don't think it's the job of the court to take on the same view as the people, but certainly to be in touch with their experiences and how they're living their lives.
Well, the Supreme Court is the ultimate arbiter of legal matters in the United States, and because of that, we're going to have congressional districts as originally drawn on the November ballot. Because of the Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade has been overturned in Louisiana after this brief hiatus. Will no longer allow abortions, and people will be supposedly arrested if they are involved in an abortion. If it's not the actual person, it will be those who provided it. And it is a new world. And Troy Hebert, our state and our nation, by virtue of the Supreme Court, we have veered to the right. You're a guy who's, I would say, about as middle as it comes. Your thoughts about where we're going as far as the social fabric of our country?
Well, you know, first let me congratulate Justice Brown. It is historic, and you mentioned it was interesting about the votes. Sounds like she went in there with a landslide with 53 votes. And I tell you, it's just indicative of what's going on with the country being so equally divided. Now, when you talk about the Supreme Court, you hear all this stuff about their way to the right. Let me say this. It's always healthy that we never have one party in charge of all three branches. So right now, the Democrats control the executive and the legislative branch, and the Republicans control the judiciary. I don't think it's unhealthy to have that debate. I'm afraid when one party controls all of them, which either party it is when the trouble starts. But right now, this abortion, as you, I think you know, your listeners have heard me before. You know, I'm not for abortion, but to not get into the mechanics of the abortion part, just the politics of it. What I'm afraid of as a conservative, I'm wondering if it's not that the Republicans aren't the dog that caught the tire. It was always good to throw at the Democrats that they for abortion and we're not and we're trying to stop it. And so I think that's now taken away the political positive for the Republicans and may have actually turned into a positive for the Democrats by igniting their base in the fall.
What do you think, Mary Patricia, as far as how this will affect the midterm election?
Oh, well, I don't have a lot of faith that it will affect the midterm elections, and I hope that I'm pleasantly surprised. But, you know, I think Troy tried to make a good point about America being equally divided, and I think that is not a great assumption to underlie these midterm elections. I don't think we're equally divided. I think we're represented by a majority viewpoint in all three branches of government. Because party is not homogenous anymore. I mean, you can see that inside the Republican and the Democratic Party. But for me, the political stuff is actually harder to get to. I think maybe that's the easier branch for Mr. Hebert to take. But for me, it's about the women who I personally know and whose stories we're seeing all over the country that are trying to get cancer care and cannot because they can't find anyone to perform a DNC. People who are having already this week problems finding a procedure to terminate a pregnancy that is not viable with no heartbeat at 32 weeks. They're in danger. Their lives are actually in danger. They're having to beg for their lives. And here in Louisiana, they're going to have to find two physicians that are willing to risk criminal prosecution just to save their own lives. And so we actually live in America where as a woman, you're going to have to beg for your life. Beg for your life.
Barry in Mid-City, you're on with Mary Patricia Ray and Troy Hebert. Hi, Barry.
Hey, good morning. For either or both your guests, my late brother, I think when you were in Israel, Jim, you met Eliyahu, may he rest. He said in his oratorical contest when we were in high school that the Supreme Court is the Constitution. And I wonder if your guest might be able to respond to that.
Well, the Supreme Court justices are appointed for life, for life. And as we saw with the judgment on the EPA yesterday, the Supreme Court can basically dismantle actions by presidents and sometimes by Congress. And I would say of the three branches of government, the Supreme Court is the most powerful. But Mary Patricia, what about Barry's comments?
Well, I mean, we're in a new era of judicial tyranny at this point. And is the Constitution a living document is a great question that a lot of people like to philosophize about. You know, I teach at Tulane Law School in New Orleans. And I think the purpose of the statement that the Supreme Court is the Constitution is that the people on the court decide today what the Constitution means for you as an individual and in regard to your individual liberties. And that's always been true, which is why it's very important that the people appointed to the court have accountability and truthfulness when they explain to the American people their viewpoints on what the Constitution says. We've got a bunch of people on the court right now, one from Louisiana, who did not tell the truth. They testified before Congress one way and then did the complete opposite.
I think they shaded the truth, and it happens, and that's the way these people get confirmed, and it's been done by Democratic nominees as well, but and there's no doubt that Kavanaugh, he said it was precedent on top of precedent, told Susan Collins that he had no intention of overthrowing Roe v. Wade, but he did, and each one of them. It was a 5-4 vote. It wasn't 6-3. It was 5-4 on the Roe v. Wade. Each one of the five cast the deciding vote. Now, Troy Hebert, these are young people on the court. Kavanaugh, appointed by Trump, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Coney Barrett will be there probably for 20 or 30 years. So When you have three members of the court locked up, signed, sealed, and delivered, you only need to get two of the other seven to win an argument. It seems the deck may be stacked in favor of the Trump appointees and the conservative members of the court. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think Mary Patricia brought out some good points, but I'll say this, is that first of all, when those justices were before the committees and the things that they said or whatever, you know, we used to call that an old Indian trick, right? They say one thing and does another. I mean, who's surprised about that in America? But let me say this, is I think one of the bigger problems, and let's go back to your point about the number of votes, Jim, is a woman or a guy who is middle of the road, who agrees sometimes liberal, sometimes conservative, they don't ever stand a chance of getting on the Supreme Court. Because as you can see, when the Democrats are in control, they're gonna want a liberal. When the Republicans are in control, they're going to want a conservative.
All right, we've got to take a 90-second break. But Troy makes a point. There are no more moderates on the court. There won't be for a while. We'll talk more after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. And for those who opine that the New York Times is a liberal rag, well, today in the part of the paper where the newspaper puts its opinion is a column from David Brooks. And David Brooks writes, "The Democratic Party is behaving recklessly and unpatriotically. So far, Democrats have spent tens of millions to help Trumpist candidates in Republican primaries. In Illinois, the Democratic Governors Association and the Democratic governor spent $30 million to attack a Trump-moderate gubernatorial candidate. In Pennsylvania, a Democratic campaign spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on ads intended to help a Trumpist candidate win the GOP gubernatorial primary. A political action committee affiliated with Nancy Pelosi worked to boost far-right Republican House candidates in California and in Colorado. They're doing it because they think far-right Trumpist candidates will be easier to beat in the general election than more moderate candidates. What the Democrats are doing, writes Mr. Brooks, is sleazy in the best of circumstances. If you love your country more than your party, you should want the best candidates to advance in either party. And in these circumstances, what they're doing is insane. The far-right candidates whom Democrats are supporting could easily wind up winning." Mary Patricia Ray.
Well, I'll be the last to defend the Democratic establishment. However, as a person living in a very red state, I find it really interesting that Mr. Brooks thinks that calling this sleazy will be an effective countermeasure, since I just don't think his fellow conservatives have really cared very much about what sleazy since about 2016. And so, you know, yeah. So, okay, I guess another conservative has said that Democrats are sleazy. It's news to the New York Times.
But David Brooks is no Trump fan. There is no doubt about that. I think he's a moderate to conservative, kind of like our guest Troy Hebert. But do both parties have some sleaze, Troy Hebert?
That is a loaded question. That's a loaded question if you're talking to Mr. Hebert.
I think we all have our sins, but let me say this. I believe we live in what I call the 20% rule in this country, and that means 20% of the population is far right, 20% is far left, and the rest of us, the 60%, are somewhere in the middle. But the problem is, in talking about with these primaries, is that what happens is again, like on the Supreme Court, the middle people, the people that's just moderate and sometimes are lean one way or the other, they don't stand a chance in these primaries. You know, Louisiana, with its open primary, I think is very good, well-placed to kind of have some moderates sometimes. But when you go to closed primaries, the most conservative person normally wins the Republican nomination and the most liberal. And then the rest of us in America have to pick. We got to hold our nose. We either want to go way to the right or way to the left. And that's what's going on with this country.
877-217-5757 for Mary Patricia Ray and Troy Hebert. David in Atlanta. Hello, David.
Good morning, everyone. You know, not one time, as far as I know, when Trump made his speech to the mob of Proud Boys and those other gangsters, the Oath Keepers. Not one time did he say, I'm going to go with you to the Capitol. Well, he did say that, but he didn't. But not one time did he mention the word peacefully protest. And he did say you have to fight if you want to keep your country. To me, that was a clear indication that he was trying to stir up a violent attack on the nation's capital.
Mary Patricia?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I'm not sure Mr. Trump is really great at words. So I'm not, I don't know that I necessarily hold two specific words missing from his vocabulary against him, because that would take, that's down a long, winding road. I mean, I think there's been a lot of testimony before the committee that has been from conservative Republicans who are supporters of Mr. Trump that have clearly portrayed what his state of mind and intent was on January 6th. And I don't think it's going to change any minds in America, the presentation, but I do think that it's important work for them to be doing.
And the star witness thus far has been the one from the other day, Cassidy Hutchinson, all of 25 years old, an aide to Mark Meadows. And her testimony was compelling, and it was searing and damaging, no doubt about it. But she came to Washington as an aide to one Steve Scalise. And Troy Hebert, I don't think she scored any points. She may have with the American people, but any points with Steve Scalise or Garrett Graves or Clay Higgins or Julia Letlow or Mike Johnson or John Kennedy, they all believe the election was stolen. Your thoughts?
Well, they certainly, their opinions are set in stone, but let's say this about the January 6th. I bet if you polled America, 90% of Americans think what happened on January 6th is wrong. But then if you poll them and you ask them another question and say, but right now, what is the most important thing Congress ought to be tackling, the fact that Democrats are in control? More importantly, what should they be tackling right now? It should be inflation. It should be immigration. It should be gas prices. And why aren't the Democrats, with them having the podium right now, why aren't they primetime TV talking about those three things? Then the American people would say, you know what? The Democrats are fighting for me. Rather, they take it on a political swing. Just like if the Republicans get in control, they're going to go after Joe Biden's son. And 90% of the people don't even care about that. Let's talk about and let's tackle things that are important to the American people.
Well, is this important? Donald Trump could very well be the next president if the truth about him is not told. And that's what the Democrats are, I think, striving to do, along with the Republicans, Liz Cheney. And
Jim, there's nothing we learned on those January 6th committees about Donald Trump that anybody's surprised about, I probably don't believe already.
Well,
you remember what he said about his constituents? He could shoot somebody in the street and they're still going to be with him.
That's right. But here's a guy who never received more than 46% of the votes, 47, and yet he was elected president. And he was elected fairly in 2016 by virtue of the way we elect presidents. But he lost one election in the overall vote by 3 million and another by 7 million. So that's a 10 million vote advantage that his opponents have had. And yet he was elected president and he could do it again. He could lose the vote and win in the Electoral College. And I think Democrats and Republicans, some Republicans, are fearful that he will do exactly that, Mary Patricia.
Well, I mean, as far as what the strategy is here, I want to address that by Democrats around this committee and why they're not on TV talking about gas prices every night. I think that the viewership for these hearings has shown that there is indeed a lot of interest in them and the outcome of them. And I want to just plant something in your mind. Women all over America watched a young, intelligent, accomplished woman come to a committee hearing and tell the truth and be completely bludgeoned all over social media, all over cable news and television. And I'm just here to tell you that regardless of political persuasion, all of us looked at that young woman and said, oh, that's happened to me. I've spoken up. I've said that I've told the truth. I've done what I was supposed to do. And I got attacked for it. I got belittled for it. I got put down for it. And whether or not they agree with what she did or agree with her politically, I'm telling you that all over America, women watched that and said, oh, I've been there. And that will actually stick with many of us for a very long time.
Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Carol, you're on with Troy and Mary Patricia.
Yes, I want to know where all these liberals are. First of all, I think
President Obama did try to nominate a moderate. And just how many times were the Democrats able to block Mitch McConnell's agenda when he was in charge? And how many times has he blocked their agenda?
All right. Well, Republicans are better at politics. Merrick Garland was considered a moderate. And I think John Roberts is a moderate to conservative justice. And of course, David Souter turned out to be a liberal, and he was appointed by Bush 1. So you never know. John Paul Stevens, appointed by Gerald Ford, was a liberal. But they were Republican appointees. But now, Mary Patricia, they are scrutinized to the point where they know what they're getting. There's going to be no doubt.
Well, just briefly, I mean, I don't necessarily think that it's Republicans are better at politics. They're better at keeping their party homogenous. They're better at keeping their party to a single view with no disparity of thought, no disparity of experience, no inclusiveness. And it's much easier to move forward with a single message when you only represent a single viewpoint.
Well, and there's hell to pay if you go against that single viewpoint. And that's what's happening with our whole congressional delegation, whether they believe it or not. They're lockstep with Trump. They are voting not to impeach him and saying that the election was stolen when we know it was not. Back with more after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Robin Dow is producing and Troy Hebert on the right, Mary Patricia on the left, and you're ready to opine with them in our remaining time if you are so inclined. 877-217-5757. Frank on Airline Highway. Frank, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I had a quote I wanted to offer from an individual named Charles Freed. Mr. Freed was Solicitor General under Reagan. About 6 months ago in the New York Times, he was quoted as saying in regard to the six conservative justices, quote, "I dislike the fact that journalists refer to the six as conservative. They're not. They're reactionaries. That's the only correct term for them." And I would just like to second Ms. Ray's assertion that they certainly have a difficulty with advancing the truth. Thank you.
All right. Well, Troy Hebert, you said 20% of the country is on the hard right, 20 on the hard left. Do you think the nine justices are in that 40%? Is that what you were implying a few moments ago?
I would think the majority of them are either way to the right or way to the left. And I think that's the danger of the Supreme Court. And, you know, that's why I want to, like, about the parties that's going to be successful is going to be the party that explains to the American people what they're for, not what the other party's against. And that's been our focus right now. And now it's about the Supreme Court or whatever. But we got to tell American people, you know, let's take Obama and Clinton, okay, and Reagan. I want to use three. They were successful because they gave people hope. And let's throw Kennedy in there. They went on the radio, they went on TV, and they gave people things to challenge them, to think about. And now all we do is to talk bad about the other person. And that's the problem where both parties are guilty is why don't we come out there if we can find – listen, if a candidate emerges that's going to go out there and talk about tomorrow instead of yesterday, that's who's going to win.
All right. Well, some believe we're turning the clock back, particularly on Roe v. Wade. Mary Patricia, in Louisiana, soon it appears almost certainly that abortion will be a crime. And at the same time, in other states, about half the country, it'll be legal and people will be able to get them without any problems. And this includes pills, by the way, medication. Your thoughts?
Well, I want to say to your caller, thanks for bringing up Mr. Freed, and just wanted to point out that he was an immigrant to this country that worked for Ronald Reagan, and I think really shows evidence of the trends of politics. He was really a thinker and a jurist, and he was succeeded by Ken Starr. I think we can kind of locate some of the things that are going on back to that time. I mean, my thoughts on what's happening in Louisiana is that people are going to get hurt. As someone who is a woman of childbearing age, a mom of two beautiful little boys, I know that, personally, I know that not every pregnancy comes to term and it is not a fun, situation. It's not a happy situation and it requires you to not, you can't just sit and grieve when you have complications with a pregnancy that threaten your life. You have to act on those things. You have to act on them immediately or your life can be in danger. And now in Louisiana, once this vagueness case gets done, which it will be disposed of, women will be begging two physicians to sign a piece of paper so that she can save her own life and continue, like in my case, to be a mom to two little boys. And I think that's sad, and I don't want to diminish that there are other reasons people seek abortions that I fully support. But I do think that if you cannot get with me on the fact that this Supreme Court decision should not be a death sentence for a woman, then I don't know what we have left to talk about, because you don't recognize me as a human with dignity, with the right to stay alive for my own children.
Troy Hebert, do men have standing on this issue? Or should we recuse ourselves?
Well, first of all, the man is actually to blame, right? Because if it wasn't for the man, and he wouldn't be pregnant. So I guess he has some part in it, but I think
not in bringing the child to term, though.
No, that's what I'm saying. But I mean, he's the cause of it. And but I think Mary Patricia brings up some good points, because, you know, let's talk about being pro-life, right? So I'm pro-life, but that means I'm for the baby living, but I'm also for the mama living also. I mean, that's what pro-life is. You can't, you know, play God and pick and choose. And so I think her point is that we're going to be going through some rough times right now and trying to, you know, maneuver a person that's stuck in this situation and has to make those tough choices that she talked about. I feel for him and I pray for him, because I, you know, as a guy, let me just be honest with you and all your listeners. It's hard for a guy to relate what a woman goes through. The reason why God let women have babies is because men wouldn't have them. It's too painful.
All right, Pat in Denham Springs. Pat, you're on. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. Jim and your guest, I'm concerned about protecting the rights of all the students who are signed up to attend universities in the state of Louisiana, especially those from out of state, and I'm talking the guys and the gals, because of the tremendous change in environment that they are coming into or have tied themselves to. And I think there should be an imperative, legal probably, to notify everyone who has signed up to come to a state university, not a state, a university in Louisiana, advising them of the change, advising them specifically of what will happen to a woman who gets pregnant.
All right. Pat makes a good point. Now, this isn't going to be an extremely good recruiting tool, I don't think, for LSU, for example, trying to get a kid from California or Illinois, a woman.
Well, I mean, a woman or man, I don't think it's going to be a great economic development tool in general. You know, when you can go somewhere else and know that you don't have to beg for your life when you have an ectopic pregnancy, you don't have to beg for your life when a doctor looks at you and tells you that your baby has no heartbeat. I'm not sure why you would, given a choice between two places, all other things being equal, choose the one where you're going to have to beg for your life.
All right. Kevin in North Baton Rouge. Kevin, you're on with Troy and Mary Patricia. Hi, Kevin.
How you doing, Dave? I'm a pro-life person, but I don't believe in judging other people because I don't know their situation. And the people that's going to be most affected by it is the rural areas, and the people who make all the decisions are white men. They always did make the decisions for everybody, Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, white, voting rights, women, and everything else.
Well, Kevin, you make a good point, and you'll be our final caller for Mary Patricia and Troy. But this essentially was a 5-4 vote, and as I said, any of the five, we're talking about Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, Coney Barrett, and the other one is Alito, who wrote the majority opinion. But one of those five is a black man, Clarence Thomas, the most conservative member of the court. If Clarence Thomas had voted the other way, Roe v. Wade would still be the law of the land. Troy Hebert, what do you think about Clarence Thomas, who's now been on the court for 31 years? Is he a good justice?
Well, I think he is, but it goes to show you that sometimes people always try to divide things by race. And you really can't. And Clarence Thomas is a prime example of that, because it's funny how the liberals, even though he's black, the liberals are calling for his head. And so, you know, some things transcend race. And that's Clarence Thomas is about the best example there is on how I guarantee you the liberals would have him on his head on a plate. And it doesn't matter that he's black. It's just I think that he's conservative and they're not for it.
Mr. Thomas definitely transcends race and party, because he does what a lot of Americans do. He votes against his own interests. His decision undermines the basis on which he's even able to be married legally to a white woman in Louisiana. And that is the least conservative thing a Supreme Court justice has done in the history of the United States Supreme Court.
All right. Ted Shermer's on deck. But finally, a few more than a few listeners wanted to get both of you briefly on guns. And this watered down gun bill was passed by Congress, signed into law by President Biden, but voted against by Senator Kennedy, by Congressman Graves, Scalise, Letlow, Johnson, Higgins, Troy Hebert. They all said no way, Jose, to any kind of gun safety regulation. Your thoughts?
Well, as this country continues to become more criminalized and people are afraid to sleep in their houses at night, I can tell you there's a lot of people that probably want to have more guns than less guns to protect themselves. And I always go back to that old bumper sticker. If you outlaw guns, then only outlaws are going to have them.
All right. Do you need an AK-47, though, or AK-15? Do you need that?
Well, I mean, listen to me. Let's say you got rid of all the AK-47s. The next thing you know, they're going to be shooting people with 22s. Okay? And so, a gun's a gun, and when you're dead, you're dead. In France, they don't allow guns, so they just stab them to death over there.
All right, but an AR-15 can take out many people in a few minutes, where stabbing people, you would think you would have a difficult time killing 21 people in a couple of minutes. An AR-15 did exactly
that. Well, back in the old lessons, they used to put two revolvers on their sides, and that way they could shoot twice as many people. I mean, I understand the semantics, but at the end of the day, is that really going to solve the problem we have with these mass shootings in America? The more important question is why we have so many in America and not other countries.
Well, as a mom of two kids, I invite all my pro-life friends to continue to attempt to do a better job proving it. I don't want my kids to die at their school, and I don't think anyone needs to buy tactical gear and mass lots of weapons and ammunition without someone looking into why they're doing it. I don't think that ever is necessary other than to kill a lot of people. And when those people are your children, maybe you will care.
Well, thank you both. Hope you both have a great holiday weekend, and always good to get your insights. Thank you, Senator Hebert, and thank you, Mary Patricia Ray.
And thanks for having us, Jim. Thanks, Troy.
Professor Ray.
Professor Ray, always enjoy it.
There you go. In just a moment, after a brief break, we're going to hear from Theodore Shermer, better known as Ted. His book, Defiance, Fighting Elitism and Racism at LSU in the 70s. He's written about his life and times. He was a 28-year-old Vietnam vet when he was elected student body president. And today, hard to believe, but Ted Shermer is celebrating birthday 75 with us. We're back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Rounding the corner, heading for home as we prepare for the holiday weekend, and appropriately on July 1, we're visiting with Ted Shermer, who made a mark that still resonates all these years later as the student body president, the SGA president of LSU in the 1970s. His book is Defiance, Fighting Elitism and Racism at LSU in the 70s. And Ted Shermer is joining us on birthday number 75, born in 1947, graduated from Estruma High School in 1966. And ironically, one of those great curious nuggets of truth, he shares a birthday with his old nemesis, David Ernest Duke, who is 72 years old today. Will you be swapping cards, Ted?
I don't believe so.
Nope. But you had a few entanglements with Mr. Duke, didn't you?
Yes, I mean, he was at the Alley periodically, and so I was one of many other students who had a lot of questions for him about his views on fascism and racism.
Fair to say, we're not in his camp, and unlike Mr. Duke, you had actually fought for our country in a war. Two tours of duty in Vietnam, and we've talked about this, but it's in your book. That's why you were a 28-year-old student body president. When you left Estruma High, you decided you wanted to fight for our country. What prompted you to have this point of view when others were tucking tail and running away?
Well, I believed a great deal in our country. Now, analyzing it, as I had to do later when I returned from Nam, to understand what I did and what I was willing to do, I had to realize that I really didn't know anything about the war, about the Vietnamese people, about the issues involved when I graduated to Estruma and volunteered for the service. But I always would say I was young, stupid, and patriotic. Now I'm older, wiser, and much more patriotic. Before I go to another person's country to kill them, I'm going to know more than I did then.
Theodore Ted Shermer is our guest. The book, Defiance, Fighting Elitism and Racism at LSU in the 70s. He was student body president in the bicentennial year of 1976 when he was 28 years old and had already had two tours of duty in Vietnam. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. And a listener who knows a bit about you notes that one of your Estruma, I don't know if he was a classmate, but he was there at the same time, Lewis Elwood Woody Jenkins, correct?
Woody graduated the year before me. I didn't get to Estruma until my senior year had already started in 65.
All right. But you got to LSU, and you became this legendary figure at Free Speech Alley. They don't do that as much anymore, but at the time, it was captivating. We didn't have social media then. Maybe we were more inclined to get out and actually talk with each other face to face. But you got many critics, and you got more than a few supporters, didn't you?
Yes, indeed, Jim. It is peculiar when you think about it. The Berkeley movement and the free speech movement in Berkeley, California, and then you think about LSU, not that long after, created their own free speech alley. And you couldn't have more different and diverse areas of the country than San Francisco and Baton Rouge. But yet the students on the campus wanted to have that kind of a forum to talk about the issues of the day.
Now, George Morris wrote an exceptional review of your book in The Advocate a few months ago. And one of the nuggets among many is a woman named Cynthia Payton, who became LSU's first Black homecoming queen finalist. But you said that they were trying to game the system and keep her from getting that honor. What happened?
Yes, it's a very long story, as you can tell by the length of the book. But it turned out, regretfully, first of all, they prevented the vice president from escorting the queen in her court because she was a woman, and because the homecoming committee said it would upset the alumni. And what would really upset them, of course, is if a Black woman became homecoming queen, as reflected even when in the 90s, finally, LSU did elect a Black homecoming queen. When you read in the Reveille about what happened to her and how she was treated, you could only imagine what would have happened in 1976.
1976, 46 years ago.
Ooh, I didn't need to hear that.
Yeah. And LSU didn't have that many Black students on campus then. One of them was Robert Dow, LSU receiver and father of our producer, Robin Dow. And how was the experience then for Black students at LSU based on your knowledge as a white guy?
Well, we did PSA when we first organized the Progressive Students Alliance. We did things with the Rhombi for a while, including taking over the seating section of one of the, I think it was Sigma Chi, if I remember right, at the Notre Dame, LSU Notre Dame football game. they were not happy campers when they came drunk 5 minutes before the game starts with their date to see a bunch of long-haired hippies and Black students sitting in their section. So, one of the things, we would like to have done more with the Rhombi at the time, but, and I agree with the members and the president saying that they prefer to basically fight those kind of issues and other issues with them without whites being involved so as not to taint what they were trying to accomplish.
Did you ever get into fist fights because of your political views at LSU?
Well, the closest, I guess you could kind of, I bit Ned Wright's finger, but he was my financial vice president, and he was basically walking off with supplies. He was in law school, taking supplies over to law school, and he was ordering all these supplies. I found out about that through Vice Chancellor Coco, who called me over. He was the comptroller at LSU, who called me to his office and said, "Ted, who is this Ned Wright guy? And did you see all the stuff he's ordering?" And it was stamps and legal pads, which we didn't use legal pads, and pens. And when I confronted Ned on that, you know, he blew it off as minor things, but he was basically handing them out at
all. All right, well, since Ned's not here to defend himself, if he wishes to respond to Ted's comments on this show, he's perfectly invited to do so. If he wants to set the record straight, I'm always in favor of that when somebody's not around to defend himself, or call in for that matter, but he may not be listening. But nonetheless, you were the subject of a recall attempt. What happened in that case?
Well, yeah, that was after homecoming. The Greeks had circulated, the fraternity sororities had circulated a petition to recall me, and they got the necessary signatures, which was much less than required to recall a governor. At the election, it was an interesting, as I said, it was a win-win situation for me. If I won, I could continue to try to get our programs done. If I lost, I was out of this shitty job.
Ted, sorry.
It's the sailor in me. Sorry.
The Navy SEAL is coming out.
So, long story short, to everybody's shock, matter of fact, the Reveille had already prepared a political cartoon showing me convicted, sitting next to Richard Milhouse Nixon in chains, you know, but we won by 20 votes. And it really freaked out all of them. And then the chancellor, they had a code of conduct hearing. They did their best to throw me out of school, you know, but they did not succeed.
Well, Ted got his law degree from Southern University in 1983. He practiced law here for a while. He ran for the state house. And then he went off to California, where he was sworn in Los Angeles. He passed the California bar and sworn in by none other than Judge Lance Ito, the guy who presided at the O.J. Simpson trial, and then worked for the public defender's office in Los Angeles until very recently. But he's had this incredible life, and how was life in California? Was it different than Louisiana, or do they have some of the same issues we have?
It was a wee bit different there, Jim. One of the interesting things that was how I think it was the Commissioner of Insurance. There was a big issue going on, and the government was actually fighting on behalf of the people and not for the insurance companies. And I took note of that. But it was a big change. But I had lived a little while in the West in Las Vegas. So being someone who had traveled a great deal as a child, I appreciate the differences in places. But the people as a whole, if you can get through politics and some other things, the people in the whole in this country is pretty much the same. It's just tough to get to that part sometimes.
Well, happy three quarters of a century to Ted Shermer. The book is Defiance, Fighting Elitism and Racism at LSU in the 70s. Theodore Shermer, that's Theodore Shermer. For those who have an interest in securing a copy, what's the best way, Ted?
Best way is probably through Amazon. I have not been able to get the book into bookstores yet into Louisiana because I haven't been able to get back either. But hopefully I'm coming back for homecoming this fall, and we'll hopefully get the book available in the area.
Well, let's talk again. Ted's always an interesting man with a past that is notable, and it's detailed and grand glory and defiance. Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Jim.
Happy 4th of July. Thank you for your service to our country. Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet provide signature support for this program. Until next time, for Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. and stay tuned.